Palestinian resistance fighters launched fresh missile strikes on Israeli cities, including Tel Aviv and Ashkelon, in response to the regime's deadly onslaught on the Gaza Strip. Iran's leader describes Palestinians' operation Al-Aqsa flood as a destructive quake and an irreparable defeat for Israel in terms of the regime's intelligence and military. And the Israeli military launches an attack on the office of Iran's Al-Alam Arabic News Network in the Gaza Strip. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Hamas says it has fired missiles towards the Ben-Gurion airport in Tel Aviv as it presses ahead with its retaliation for Israel's relentless bombardment of the Gaza Strip. The resistance group says it has also targeted Tel Aviv itself. According to Israeli media, sirens sounded in areas in and around Tel Aviv. Sirens were also heard in the city of Ashdod, south of Tel Aviv. Meanwhile, a large salvo of rockets was fired toward the Israeli town of Ashkelon. That after the armed wing of Hamas issued a warning to the residents to leave the town. The Al-Qassam Brigades said the attack was in response to Israeli bombing of Gaza. Palestinian resistance fighters entered the Gaza envelope area on Saturday following missile strikes on Israeli targets under the Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. According to Israeli media, the operation has led to the death of over 900 Israelis and more than 2,800 injuries. Israel's embassy in the U.S. has put the death toll at over 1,000. Hamas says the Palestinian resistance has more to catch the Israeli enemy off guard, both in terms of weapon capabilities and the resilience to manage a protracted battle. Hamas spokesperson Hazem Qassem said the aftermath of Operation Al-Aqsa Flood continues to rattle the regime, adding that Israel is lying about regaining settlements near Gaza. He also said the regime is seeking to make up for the unprecedented humiliation of its army by targeting more civilians. The resistance movement had earlier said it is ready for a prolonged battle and any possibility. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution describes as a destructive quake the anti-Israel operation launched by Palestinians on Saturday. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said those who attribute the operation to non-Palestinians are making mistakes. The leader underlined that the damage inflicted on Israel in the surprise operation by Palestinians is the result of the regime's own actions. Ayatollah Khamenei said the brave move by Palestinians was a response to years of Israeli crimes. The leader said Israel is now playing the victim card and that Western media outlets are helping the regime in this regard. Ayatollah Khamenei noted that the regime cannot be portrayed as an oppressed entity while it is actually a monster. He warned Israel and its backers that the bloodshed of Palestinians will bring them greater calamity. Meanwhile, Israel is pressing ahead with its large-scale offensive against Gaza, pounding the besieged strip indiscriminately. Israeli warplanes are raining down bombs on multiple areas across the Gaza Strip, using phosphorus bombs in parts of the enclave. The regime has also threatened to bomb an area home to foreign companies and embassies. Israel started its attacks on Saturday after resistance groups launched a multi-front operation against the regime. Nearly 800 Palestinians have been killed and around 4,000 others injured so far. As the victims of Israeli attacks were being rushed to the hospitals in Gaza on Monday, citizens of the besieged territory urged fellow Palestinians and the international community to come to their aid. Israeli warplanes have targeted the office of Iran's Al-Alam Arabic News Network in the Gaza Strip. Activities of the office, which is located in the Al-Ramal neighborhood in Gaza, have been completely halted following the bombardment. None of the employees of the news network were injured in the attack. At least seven journalists have been killed in Israeli attacks in recent days. Israel has a history of launching attacks on news networks and media personnel. Back in 2021, during the 11-day war on the Gaza Strip, the regime conducted an airstrike on a building that hosted offices of several media outlets, including Qatar's Al Jazeera. Israel's indiscriminate bombings of Gaza are also taking the lives and destroying homes and offices of reporters who are covering the regime's brutalities. Israeli warplanes have hit the residence of our correspondent in Gaza, Ashraf Shannon.
Well, yesterday, as I was covering the news here from Shifa Hospital, we've learned that my neighborhood was targeted by Israeli F-16 fighter jets. And the fact that roads were blocked and no internet access in the area, so no one knew exactly what happened there, except for seeing some of my neighbors, they were injured, who were inside their homes when the bombing happened, and they told me that their houses were bombed. And even checked with my family, who already evacuated the area 6 hours before the bombing, fearing for their lives. They went to a friend's family's far away from my neighborhood. Now, around 1:30 a.m., one of my neighbors managed to get some internet access, and then he sent the photo of the house to one of my sons, and he posted it on Facebook. I wasn't shocked. I thought maybe some partial damage happened to the house. I didn't expect a six-story building to be almost gone. It was hit directly by a missile from the Israeli regime or a bomb. Luckily, no one was in the building, but there is no, I mean, I don't know how to describe this. All of a sudden, after I heard the news, and I was sure that the building is gone, I started telling my colleagues, yesterday I had a home, and now I'm homeless, me and my family.
The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement has described Operation Al-Aqsa Flood as a natural response to Israel's relentless oppression against Palestinians. Abdul Malik al-Houthi emphasized that the Palestinian people have been left with no choice but to fight for their rights. He also strongly rebuked some Arab and Muslim nations for standing idly by in the face of Israeli crimes. The Ansarullah leader condemned Western states, particularly the U.S., for their complicity in the regime's atrocities. He also advised Washington against direct involvement in the ongoing conflict, warning that Yemen is ready to help Palestinians if the U.S. becomes engaged in the fight. Additionally, Houthi criticized some Arab states for normalizing relations with Israel, describing it as part of Washington's plot to undermine the Palestinian cause. Mariam Saleh is a correspondent joining us from Qajar in Lebanon to tell us what's going on in that area. And for an analysis, Zakir Ahmed Mayat, who's an attorney, activist, and political analyst, joins us from Johannesburg. Welcome to you both. Mariam, over to you. I believe that there have been some developments where you are at or where that particular area of Lebanon with Israel. What has happened?
Well, actually, around 40 minutes ago, the residents of the southern coast heard the sound of rockets being fired from the area, mainly in the area of southern Tyre. And they heard the rockets, and after the rockets, just minutes later, we heard Israeli artillery fire. Now, it wasn't clear whether those rockets actually reached the Galilee, but we do know that sirens sounded in the northern Galilee near here, and we also heard the sound of the rockets. We then heard the sound of the shelling, of the Israeli shelling in that area, specifically in the areas surrounding the Naqoura area, which is at the coast, the southern coast near also Dhaira. That area also was pounded by Israeli shelling just yesterday. So basically the Israelis are shelling areas that are not really residential, the outskirts of the villages. Yesterday they did manage to target some areas, and that which led to the martyrdom of three of Hezbollah's fighters. Now, if you can see also behind me, let me move away from the picture so you can get an idea also that we are still near the settlement. And this is one settlement which is called Mtilli, facing the Al-Khiyam town. This is one of the areas that is considered a residential area, perhaps a area where you have settlements, but as settlers. But at this very moment, it is evacuated. We have absolutely no settlers in these homes. Any movement that there is in this area is purely military. Even those moving in civilian cars are considered members of either the Israeli intelligence or members of the Israeli army. So therefore, the Israelis are on high alert. They have blocked also some of the areas and put even heavy walls in areas in case there is any sort of escalation or clashes. We saw also, we witnessed the movement of one Merkava tank. We heard right now also the sound of shelling. It's not clear whether it is rockets that were fired from South Lebanon or Israeli shelling. And despite the fact that many analysts saw that the situation is somewhat contained, however, there have been just direct responses and firing at from both sides. Even Hezbollah, when they fired at the Israeli post, they did that using mortar rockets, not using, for example, precise rockets and so on. Now, we know that from the rockets that were shelled today, reportedly, they were Katyusha rockets. And since before this this crisis, we know that it was always Palestinian factions that were firing Katyusha rockets from South Lebanon. And we also know that, of course, the Palestinian resistance has said that it has the right to liberate its land from both sides, whether from the north or from the south. You have Palestinian factions that are quite active in Lebanon. For example, Islamic Jihad with its Saraya al-Quds groups, and even Hamas is also active here, whether politically or even when it comes to the ground of using Lebanon, of course, as training ground, that they have a lot of refugees. Of course, there are several refugee camps that are considered strongholds for the resistance in Palestine. But since there is a huge number of Palestinians in the diaspora, they have, of course, a strong supportive ground here in Lebanon, since many of the refugees live in these 12 camps, actually. So basically, what we do have for now is just these direct responses. We don't have any reports of civilian casualties so far. There are Israeli reports that they speculate that there is another infiltration in one of the border points, also into the Galilee, but that too has not been authenticated. So we're still waiting to see. I don't know if you heard that, but we just heard now the sound of Israeli shelling. We could probably have a long night if this issue continues in such a way.
Yeah, we didn't hear that, unfortunately. If it was, it didn't come through on the mic that you have. But basically, looking at some of the wires there, what you have said is confirmed. Let's bring in Zakir into the picture here. Zakir Ahmed Mayat, attorney, activist, and political analyst. Zakir Ahmed, welcome to the program. You know, when you take a look at this operation that has happened, obviously there's so many different dimensions to it, Al-Aqsa flood. Well, right now, what is your viewpoint on why Israel is and how Israel is pounding the Gaza Strip? I mean, it seems like they just want to basically murder Palestinians. I mean, they're hitting all the buildings there. These Palestinians don't have anywhere to hide. I mean, their only place is the buildings that they are in. So what do you think the point of that operation by Israel is, by attacking the Gaza Strip and then killing Palestinians as a result?
So there's a few reasons as to why Israel is doing that at the moment. The first reason is to exact revenge and try and bolster some of the emotions that are boiling within Israel, that the administration has done nothing to protect Israeli citizens. This is their way of pleasing the crowd, so to say. The spilling of blood of Palestinians is surely a crowd pleaser. So that is exactly why we're seeing the Israeli regime bombing anything, including the Rafah border. We saw there were approximately four strikes on Rafah to send a message to the Egyptians to not provide any supplies. There's a second reason as to why Israel is doing this, and the second reason is to level Gaza so as to prepare for ground invasion. The third reason, and a very important reason, is that Israel was caught by surprise. They had gotten into a position where their arrogance blinded them from seeing the developments on the ground. And it was the Israeli assessment, you'd see it through numerous think tanks, JISS, INSS, Miriam Institute, the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs. Numerous Israeli think tanks believe that Hamas was deterred, Hamas would not be entering the conflict, and this is a very tactical game that was played by the resistance. In fact, the last two large engagements were by Islamic Jihad. Hamas did not enter, and this created the perception that they had no appetite for a war. But the reason why Israel is bombing now is to buy time for themselves. This is simply because they are not ready. In fact, the request was sent to the United States to provide Israel with combat boots and uniforms. They do not even have that to equip their army. That is why they have called up the reserves of about 360,000, but they're not capable of outfitting this entire military, and also that's not the complete figure. There's a formula called the tooth-to-tail figure, and therefore it's not 360,000 active troops that will be in Gaza. There's support roles, logistic roles, etc., that many of these troops will be involved in. So there are a couple of reasons as to why they are doing it in this manner and fashion, because simply they're just not ready. They fear a ground operation. They fear the amalgamation of their troops, because they are very aware, and we've learned these lessons from the Ukraine-Russia conflict, that the moment they concentrate their troops, they will come under very heavy fire. And if they begin this ground invasion, it's going to be a slaughter in Gaza, not for the Gazans, but for the Israelis, and they're fully aware of it. The Israelis are used to kinetic operations, quick operations, bomb and remove yourself from the situation. This is not that. The Palestinians have suffered for many years, and they are ready for this final battle.
There was Zakir Ahmed. And that is it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The conversation. Hi, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. On this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we look at concerns around police corruption and media freedom. Our special guest is an award-winning journalist who's been at the centre of recent controversy regarding clandestine efforts by both the police and security services in attempts to access his confidential sources. But before we do, let's get a rundown on what seems to be a recurring theme within policing institutions.
In 2014, Theresa May, the then British Home Secretary, commissioned a public inquiry into allegations that undercover police officers had spied on the family of Stephen Lawrence during their campaign to compel police to investigate the racist murder of their son. May called the revelations profoundly shocking and disturbing. Retired Judge Sir John Mitting was appointed to examine the conduct of officers who'd spied on more than 1,000 political groups between 1968 and at least 2010. In June, Mitting's first report was published, arising out of the inquiry's work and what has now become known as the Spy Cop scandal. It also followed revelations that undercover officers were regularly involved in long-term sexual relationships with women during this time. At least four of the undercover officers are known or alleged to have fathered children with women they met during their work. In July this year, more revelations have been uncovered, this time with the Police Service of Northern Ireland, the PSNI, into allegations that they had obtained the authorisation to access telephone records of journalist Barry McCaffrey. after he approached the PSNI's press office in 2013 with questions for a story he was working on about alleged corruption in the police force. McCaffrey was later arrested along with fellow journalist Trevor Burney after a documentary they were both involved in exploring the role of police collusion into the deaths of six civilians in Loughlin Island in 1994 uncovered a cover-up into the killings. These latest allegations once again shine a spotlight into a police force that has been at the centre of a number of controversies since it was reformed and renamed following the Patton Inquiry's recommendations in 2001.
As always, we are joined by our resident co-presenter, Michelle Gildenew. Michelle is the current MP for Fermanagh South Tyrone. She has served in the Northern Ireland Assembly as a former Minister for Agriculture and Rural Development and chairperson of the Health Committee, amongst other things. Michelle has been a Sinn Féin activist since her teens and has been elected almost continuously since 1998. And today's special guest is award-winning journalist Barry McCaffrey. Many of you might remember Barry from the film No Stone Unturned, an explosive expose that shone the spotlight on British state collusion in the massacre of six civilians who were watching the Republic of Ireland play Italy at the World Cup in June 1994. Instead of Barry's investigative work imploring the police to examine the findings and prosecute the suspects, he and fellow journalist Trevor Burney became the focus of police attention. This led to both men being arrested in August 2018, only to be later vindicated and awarded damages. Barry, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sean.
Firstly, Barry, how did you become a journalist?
Just by chance, Sean. I had work experience at school. Ended up in the Irish News. You know, it was 1985. Computers hadn't come in then. It was still typewriters and Tippex and things like that. Then it's during summer holidays, I would have volunteered for the Irish Times. It used to be in Phantom House in Belfast, and ended up working on building sites in Jersey in the late 80s and early 90s, and eventually came home, was doing a night class just for the headspace to do something, and somebody ended up saying that they were going to do a journalist course, and I just followed them. So it was just always by chance,
Barry, we're going to talk a wee bit about your work on the film No Stone Unturned, but before we do that, we're going to have a wee look at the trailer for the film.
The World Cup Finals. I'd say the biggest day in Irish international soccer history.
Slaughter in Loughlin Island as loyalist terrorists shoot 11 people in the back as they watch the World Cup on television.
And I just remember Mummy saying to us that bad men had come into the pub and they'd shot six people and Daddy was dead.
Did you see anything?
No.
The getaway car was discovered the morning after the attack.
There was just a sense that something wasn't right.
Somebody somewhere helped these people cover this up.
We were thwarted all the time. Every question we asked, we were told, we can't tell you that, that's national security.
They were absolutely ruthless.
I'll never forget their words, we will leave no stone unturned, and those words ring in my ear to this day, because I don't think they ever left a stone, never mind turned it.
So I was briefed to go down to Belfast and interview several people. What was unusual is that I was told who I could speak to, who I couldn't speak to, what they would be saying, but just as importantly, what they wouldn't be saying.
Certainly the bigger picture was there was this gang in operation and they were involved in serious criminality.
Obviously there was things going on above my head.
The paper trail will lead to the British government and they cannot allow that to happen.
The police were saying the car was destroyed. I thought, hold on, the largest physical exhibit in the case and you've destroyed it?
10 years with no information, we were kept in the dark.
They knew all along about the dirty war.
You're taking me into an area that I don't really want to go to.
I can't take the risk.
If I can hit somebody early enough and there's a weak one amongst this team, they might start tumbling.
How come they didn't do it?
Good question.
I really do believe
it goes as far
up to the right to the top.
It still gets me every time, Barry, every time I see a trailer or a piece of the film or the film itself, you know, just what the families went through, the victims went through, and, you know, the events that evening were horrendous, but the events leading from that and the way the police didn't investigate still leaves you with more questions than answers, doesn't it?
Oh, yes, yeah. Especially for the families, you know, nearly 30 years later, they still... the only answers they've got is they found them out themselves, you know, and they've had to drag the RUC and the PSNI, you know, kicking and screaming into court to try and get any truth whatsoever. And, you know, that quest, that challenge still goes on. You know, the PSNI seem to be more interested in protecting, you know, the man who they say was the killer, rather than giving the families justice.
Mm-hmm. And tell us just a bit more about the film. How did you become involved in the film itself? What had happened?
Well, it went back to, so for the first 10 years, from 1994 to 2005, the families kept a dignified silence. They didn't do any media. They didn't speak at all, because the police had told them, leave it with us, you know, we will leave no stone unturned, you know, and they put their trust in the police, which you would do in, you know, if you lived in Dublin or London or Glasgow, you trust, it's supposed to be a police service, somebody who serves the public, protects the public. So, like every decent person, the families believed that, you know, the police were their best option. And then in 2005, they realised that they'd been told lies for 10 years. And through Niall Murphy, their solicitor, they agreed to speak for the first time. And they did that through myself with the Irish News. And Niall and the families... had tried to do documentaries with the BBC, but the BBC had told them that they weren't interested in legacy cases anymore. And it was just a chance meeting between Trevor and Niall and myself. And Trevor said, well, why don't we do something? That because we were naming the killers or the people who the PSNI said carried out the murders, we were concerned that we would be injuncted, and you know, their identities or the role that they played would never be exposed.
So incredibly, Barry, after all that had been exposed and what had been seen within the film and the expectations that would have been there, you were arrested along with Trevor Burney.
Yes, yeah. Trevor and myself were arrested on the 31st of August 2018. To go back, when the film premiered, we expected a reaction from the PSNI. Probably naively, we expected the PSNI to say, "Right, we look at the allegations in this film, and you know, we'll reopen the investigation, and if we find that they are true, you know, we'll go after the killers." And if it's not, the filmmakers will be discredited. But instead, what they did was they did say that they would reopen the investigation, but it was to find out who our sources were, and that was, you know, that was a scary moment, or you started to realise. This is a bit strange. You're not going after the killers anymore. You're shooting the messenger, and that was so. That led on for a year, and you know, we had our concerns about what would happen, but we never thought that we would be arrested. The normal tried and tested method that the relationship between the police and any police force and journalists or filmmakers, if the police believe you have information that they believe, you know, could help solve a crime or whatever, they go to court and they look for a production order from a judge. And they go into court, and the journalists or the filmmakers go into court, and you argue the issue out in front of a judge, and a judge decides. And that's the way it should have been. That's the way anywhere else in the world that it happens. But that's not the way it happens here. So on the 31st of August 2018, 7 a.m., so I look down the stairs and I see this blue boiler suit, this figure in a blue boiler suit, you know, at the front door. And it's at that stage you think, right, that's either one or two people. That's either the UVF or the killer coming to shoot us, or it's the police. You have a decision to make at that stage, you know, do you run back in and hide underneath the bed, you know, or, you know, do you let them put the door in, or what do you do? So I decided, you know, I'd just go down the stairs and sort of front it out, whatever it was, you know. And I was sort of delighted when it was a cop at the door, you know. I felt like hugging him. We arrive at Musgrave Street Police Station, and there's two levels to Musgrave Street. There's the ground level was for the shoplifters, and, you know, somebody got drunk and made a fool of themselves or whatever. And then the second level, the penthouse, that's the anti-terror suite, that's the Bin Laden suite. And I was hoping we were going down into the shoplifters, but no, we ended up going up in the lift. And then you're stripped, and you've DNA taken, your fingerprints and all of that. And then you're putting your shoes are off, and you're putting the cell or whatever. And then you have a wee cry to yourself, you know. You get in underneath the blanket, and you just, you know, all you want's your mummy. And that went on. Shocking at that stage to see the day where the main prosecution witness against us was the man who they say killed six people. And that's how perverse the PSNI, the investigation was. They weren't trying to find, they weren't trying to find justice for the Loughran Island families. They were using the killer against us to try and, you know, to try and shut us up.
Mental. It just illustrates very clearly how dysfunctional this place is, doesn't it? But you've also then, Barry, because it just doesn't end there, and the raid and the arrest and all the rest of it. You've recently been at the centre of a police spying scandal where the Investigative Powers Tribunal, set up to investigate complaints against the intelligence services and public authorities, have uncovered a further case going back to 2013.
So we initially thought that it was going to be about Loughran Island. That's, you know, that's what we were really interested in. But the IPT came back and said, no, sorry, you were spied on actually 5 years earlier in 2013. And we're going to investigate this case or this incident first before we get to Loughran Island. And it was only by cross-referencing the dates that we realised what the case was about, because they don't tell you what you were being spied on. And it was only through sheer luck that when I cross-referenced the dates, I realised that actually what it was a story that I was doing about police corruption.
You're still tuned in to The Conversation, your weekly alternative probe of political events and current affairs around Ireland. I'm joined by my co-host, Michelle Gildernew, alongside our special guest, investigative journalist, Barry McCaffrey.
Thank you, Sean.
So obviously all of that is going to have an impact on public confidence in the PSNI. Do you think that extends to academia or trade unions or other professions as well?
I have no doubt that what has happened to Trevor and myself, we're just the tip of the iceberg. We have met with a broad range of people from academia, NGOs, and right across society. And what has been most alarming is that this isn't a one-off. We have no doubt it's happening to journalists. They're spying not only on journalists, but we met one person who was a member of the policing board, who was a civilian member of the policing board, and they were able to tell us that the exact same thing had happened to them. The chief constable needs to front up now and tell us, you know, this isn't Stasi Germany. It's not supposed to be Stasi Germany. A police service is supposed to serve the public. They're not supposed to spy on, especially people who are only doing their job. Journalists, we are entrusted by society to hold government and government agencies to account. Journalism isn't a crime.
Mm-hmm. And how damaging overall do you think this has been to public confidence?
I think this is just the latest in a long line of, you know, self-inflicted mistakes that the PSNI have committed on themselves. How is society supposed to have confidence in policing when we now know that police are, why, you know, what have the PSNI to hide? Why are they spying on us? Why didn't they come out and say, sorry, there's an allegation of police corruption and we're investigating it? Mm-hmm. Why did they, and why are they still trying to hide through these secret courts?
Yeah, Barry, I suppose many of us grew up with police and army raids on our homes in the 70s and 80s, but the ones post Good Friday Agreement were nearly worse because there was a different environment in which they were happening. But that raid on you and your family, it was a terrible ordeal. You know, what impact did it have?
It's like a boomerang. It keeps on coming back. You know, so you have to, I'd be very open about it challenges with mental health or whatever. So you have to talk to people. You have to cope with it. Some people just, you can compartmentalize it and, put it away. It takes a heavy toll.
And after all that's happened, Murray, how do you view, do you still have confidence in the police?
We have to bring this thing right to the very end to defend press freedom. Because if we don't fight it to the last, stretch, they'll do this again and again. We have to make sure that what they have done never happens again. Mm-hmm. Because if they're not, and the only way we can do that is if they are held to account. So they can't have these secret hearings and, closed door hearings that we don't get into, that our solicitors don't get into. The PSNI can tell whatever lies they want in there, and nobody's there to challenge it because we're not allowed in. If we are going to restore confidence in policing, it has to be open and it has to be transparent. And the PSNI have to come out and say, sorry, we spied on, so many, whether it's journalists, NGOs, politicians, ordinary people in the street. You know, that's what the Stasi had to do. The files were opened. That's what, so if the PSNI have files on every member in society that they shouldn't have, if they have been spying on the people in society, well, let's open the files. It was good enough for Germany. It was good enough for South Africa, but the home of democracy, British democracy. If this is a democratic society, let's open the files. Because if they have done nothing wrong, they have nothing to fear of. That's the thing. Either they have done wrong or they haven't done wrong. And if they haven't done something wrong, let's have it open in court.
Well, Barry, listen, I want to thank you for coming in again. It's always a pleasure to
thank
see you.
Thank you, Michelle.
We want to wish you all the best for the future.
Thank you.
Thank you. This week, we took our cameras to Dublin to have a look at the Moore Street campaign, where a small number of activists have been challenging the Irish government to maintain the cultural integrity of an area described by the National Museum of Ireland as the most important site in modern Irish history.
In April 1916, the course of Irish history changed forever. In a rebellion that witnessed hundreds of armed revolutionaries take on the might of the British Empire, a call for a national right to freedom and sovereignty was read out by one of the leaders of the rising, Padraig Pearse, as he stood with an armed guard on the steps of the GPO in Dublin. After a number of days of pitched street battles and heavy bombardments by the British Army, a decision was made to evacuate what now had been the centre of the insurgency at the General Post Office in O'Connell Street.
With the building now in flames, the remaining Republican defenders made their way to 5 Moore Street and began tunnelling from house to house along the street. The following morning, one of the leaders, James Connolly, was wrapped in blankets and carried through the holes they forced in the walls to number 16. In a small room, Sean McDermott, Padraig Pearce, Joseph Plunkett, James Connolly and Tom Clark discussed the limited options open to them, including rushing the British Army barricade on Parnell Street. Tom Clark, who went to look at the situation, returned to tell the leaders that it could not succeed. The leaders came to the reluctant conclusion that surrender was the only choice open to them to avoid further loss of life. Julia Grennan, Winifred Carney and Elizabeth O'Farrell had stayed throughout Easter week in the GPO. O'Farrell was now tasked with a dangerous responsibility, going to the British lines where General Lowe informed her that he would only accept unconditional surrender. A short time later, Padraig Pearce, accompanied by O'Farrell and wearing his military coat and hat, left the Moore Street headquarters of the Provisional Government to meet General Lowe. The insurrection was now over. All signatories to the proclamation were later executed by the British government. 107 years later, and this historical and iconic battlefield area is under threat from corporate interests. Commercial plans have been drawn up to bulldoze one of Ireland's most important historical sites, but not without a fight. The Moore Street Preservation Trust, led by the relatives of the signatories of the 1916 Proclamation of the Irish Republic, have been pressuring the Irish government to commit to preserve the site in order to instead develop the area into a 1916 cultural quarter in the heart of Dublin. Rather than witness the further gentrification of the capital city, the group aims to enrich and preserve the quarter, reflecting the aims and ideals of the men and women of 1916. US filmmaker Ron Maxwell describes it well. Battlefields are looking glasses into the world of our ancestors. Standing on their earth under the skies is to be at one with them and to viscerally understand humanity's connections across time. The generation that won independence lives in the ideas we honour, the architecture we preserve, and the battlefields we can yet save. As it now stands, the future of one of Ireland's most iconic historical sites is in the balance. A decision by the planning board is imminent. What will the future hold?
And that does it for another week. We'd love for you to join the conversation by sharing the link to today's programme across all our social media platforms. I'd like to thank our special guest, Barry McCaffrey, and my co-host, Michelle Gildenew. In the meantime, the conversation will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. I'm Sean Murray. Bye for now.
Ocean of Dua.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll adopt a thematic approach towards supplication and we'll have a look at supplication from the point of view of different verses of the Holy Quran. And we'll also have a look at some parts of the transmitted supplications as well as the whispered prayers. So stay with us. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil Brothers and sisters, in the previous episodes, we concluded that based on the discussions we have had so far upon the concept of closeness and nearness to the Almighty Allah through supplication, we can understand that there are different effects for supplication. The first is that it fills out the gaps, the existential gaps in the human nature. The second point is that it gives human beings grandeur and glory with which they can confront the problems and challenges more easily. And the third effect of supplication is that it actually is in itself belief in the Almighty Allah. And this belief accompanies numerous hidden benefits. But how does it do that? How does engagement in supplication entail belief in God? It is as simple as this, that because human beings are full of needs and they have to try and do their best to satisfy those needs, so they always look for assistance. And if they believe in the Almighty Allah as the assistance, if they turn themselves to Him, if they know Him as the one who can help them, this means engaging in worship. This means engaging in supplication. Now, we were having a look at the different verses of the Holy Quran that recommend the remembrance of God. Now, in this episode, we will have a look at this verse. يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا لَا تُلْهِكُمْ أَمْوَالُكُمْ وَلَا أَوْلَادُكُمْ عَنْ ذِكْرِ اللَّهِ وَمَنْ يَفْعَلْ ذَلِكَ فَأُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الْخَاسِرُونَ Oh, those who believe, let not your wealth or your children divert you from the remembrance of Allah. لا تلهكم أموالكم ولا أولادكم عن ذكر الله. And whoever does that, ومن يفعل ذلك, these are the losers. ومن يفعل ذلك فأولئك هم الخاسرون. This verse of the Holy Quran starts actually with this, O you who believe. This means those who are actually believing in the Almighty Allah must set this as their path, the path of supplication. They must know and they must choose to stand in the path of supplication. But they have to notice one important point. المال والبنون زينة الحياة الدنيا. Your wealth, your children, they are actually things that can divert you from the remembrance of the Almighty Allah. This means that, of course, we should pay attention to these beauties, these superficial beauties of the world, but we must look at them and consider them as the other intermediaries, as the other things that we can reach the Almighty Allah with. This is the point. And this verse of the Holy Quran introduces the great and real loss as being diverted from the remembrance of Almighty Allah. This actually means that if you forget the Almighty Allah, you are the actual, you are the definitive, you are the true meaning, you are the embodiment of loss. This is the point. This means not only you will lose all you have had, but also you will not gain anything as well. This is real loss. أُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الْخَاسِرُونَ This means that neglecting the Almighty Allah, not remembering Him, is so dangerous that it will even distract the believers. Oh, you who believe, that's the point. But remembrance of the Almighty Allah is what the problem is dealt with in this case.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean, And he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water. The ocean is infinite. Inasmuch as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, "Har khujo mushkil, javab onjo ravad." Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Har khujo kashti, ab onjo ravad. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Ab kamju, tishnagi avar bedast. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. Ta beju shad abaz. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the merciful God will come towards you. Paradise, thank you Allah, that we're here, feeling so good, about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward. The ocean of dua.
So, dear listeners, as you were with us, we discussed this verse in this episode. يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا لَا تُلْهِكُمْ أَمْوَالُكُمْ وَلَا أَوْلَادُكُمْ عَنْ ذِكْرِ اللَّهِ. O you who believe, let not your wealth, your children, divert you from the remembrance of Almighty Allah. And this remembrance of the Almighty Allah could include, it could encompass everything. But what is the highest form of supplication? What is that highest form of remembrance of the Almighty Allah? Of course, it is salat. It is this that is having the highest form, the best form, the embodiment of remembrance of the Almighty Allah. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this episode as well. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.